Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. The story of the United States is struggle between white and black, which was at the core of the Civil War a century and a half ago. The three-century genocide against Native Americans is a third leg of the racial triangle. Intense resistance against institutional racism is necessary if the nation as a whole is to resolve the bitter enmity between American blacks and whites. A few years ago, a television personality gaffed himself in an interview with a reporter from a gay magazine who quoted him as saying, "Most people are born with equal intelligence, but blacks have watered down their genes because the less intelligent ones are the ones that have the most children." He later defended himself. "I said the least fit are proliferating, and I didn't say blacks." A subsequent imbroglio caused by this champion of breeding only by people of breeding aside, he pointed out an increasing problem about the world population explosion. Humanity is more prolific than rats, almost. As Abraham Lincoln said, God must love poor people because he made so many of them. Most of the world's children are poor and hungry, with little chance of education or sustaining employment. It is myopic as well as deceptive to attribute the problem of breeding slowly to the people begetting the children. After all, rich or poor, educated or illiterate, black, white, etc., humanity's single, compelling, and insensate purpose is to breed, to instinctively and virtually mindlessly perpetuate the species, whether it is a good idea or not. The implication is that intelligent folk are losing genetic headway because they aren't multiplying as rapidly as mentally deficient folk. Yet, given that for millions of years, adolescence has been the prime breeding time for human beings, despite modern society's disapproval, perhaps an unwed teenage mother from the inner city has a better chance of producing healthier stock than upscale 30-somethings who establish careers before children. The idea that the least fit are proliferating does not probe the circumstances that might qualify some people less fit to reproduce than others. And if it does indeed target blacks, it is actually on the mark, though for quite opposite reasons than implied. Impoverishment, malnutrition, chronic unemployment, lack of education or opportunity for education are major factors toward dissolving the potency of a community, a nation, a race. They are not the result of inferior genes, but of defective social and political policies that might rightfully, though cautiously, be called genocide. Blacks in America have always been a suppressed people. Slaves or free, their arduous, tragic, and unequal role in building and defending the nation has always been devalued and generally ignored. Yet the black struggle for civic and social equality, particularly in the civil rights movement, has been the most inspiring and closest to the revolution of enlightenment that gave birth to this nation than any other. This is a struggle our revered white revolutionary ancestors started but denied people of color, who were regarded as property rather than persons born equal, and certainly not born free. The renewed and vengeful backlash of prejudice and oppression against American blacks for having dared challenge white supremacy is revealed as more insidious than mere colonialism or neo-apartheid if it is realized that an underlying intent is for them to indeed breed themselves into helpless oblivion without any means of support for survival, and in turn dissolve the will and capacity for them to continue as a people as well as persons. Before Sartre branded the U.S. war against Vietnam as genocide, he cautioned that the word must be used sparingly and precisely, or it loses its meaning and power, which it has, partially because Sartre freed its use. Genocide is defined as the deliberate and systematic destruction of a racial, cultural, or political group. Genocide can be overtly applied through war or by establishing death camps. It can also be carried out more subtly, over a long period through political and social attrition. One of Voltaire's friends said that there would never be justice, equality, or freedom in the world unless the last king was strangled with the intestines of the last priest. He might have included dispatching racial supremacists. Not only do they cause much of the world's troubles, they also substantiate the general theory of genetic defectiveness. Skinheads, as a friend of mine says, have more hair than brains. Now, I would like to read by George Yancey. It's Black History Month. Look in the mirror. And start with a couple of quotes. One by Ralph Ellison from his book Invisible Man. That blackness is most black, brothers, most black. And W.E.B. Du Bois from his book The Souls of Black Folk, written in 1903. One ever feels his two-ness, an American, a Negro, two souls, two thoughts, two unreconciled strivings, two warring ideals in one dark body whose dogged strength alone keeps it from being torn asunder. To many Americans, February, first officially recognized by President Gerald Ford in 1976, is a time to celebrate African-American achievements, ones that were gained against nearly impossible economic, social, and political odds. But there is one achievement that is rarely on the list. As a people, African-Americans forced the United States of America to look deep into its own soul and see the moral bankruptcy that lay there. That bankruptcy was exposed as African Americans struggled to live under white supremacy, a system that rendered them sub-persons. And even as we fought to make America our home, a home that is already brutally taken from Native Americans by white colonial settlers, our black bodies were subject to unconscionable white enslavement, violence, and oppression. We lived through forms of carnage, mutilation, rape, castration, and injustice that will forever mark the profound ethical failure of this country. By surviving and demonstrating that the American experiment had failed black people and minorities, we became far more American than those who withheld America's promise. On paper, America stood for freedom, yet that freedom was denied to black people. White America, white people, lived in a profound form of what Sartre called bad faith, a state of inauthenticity and self-deception. The white social critic Lillian Smith, who lived from 1896 to 1966, who grew up in the Deep South and later wrote Killers of the Dream, observed, "I had learned that God so loved the world he gave his only begotten son so that we might have segregated churches." She also noted, "I learned it is possible to be a Christian and a white Southerner simultaneously, and to pray at night and ride Jim Crow cars the next morning, and to feel comfortable in doing both." It is this bad faith, this ethical perversity, that haunts the history of white America. And as Frederick Douglass noted, "Between the Christianity of this land and the Christianity of Christ, I recognize the widest possible difference." And in his speech, "What to the Slave is the 4th of July," which he made in 1852, Douglass said to white America, "The 4th of July is yours, not mine. You may rejoice. I must mourn." As I listened to President Donald Trump's Black History Month remarks on February 1st, it was painfully clear that he didn't bear witness to that Douglass. It is convenient for him not to know that Douglass. In this nightmare of Trumpism, we must not forget Douglass's words, just as we must not forget the dejection felt by those who suffered under the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, or in the anti-Japanese internment camps during World War II. Those actions contradicted America's alleged identity as a nation whose arms are open to the stranger, the outcast, a nation that, in theory, does not discriminate based upon race or national origin. It is this brutal and contradictory history from which America cannot and should not turn away. Just as Jews refused to forget Hitler's Germany, we Black Americans refuse to forget the often unspeakable atrocities we endured. It is this resistance to forgetting that we must be nurtured as we find ourselves in the midst of a dangerous form of anti-globalism, white nativism, and xenophobia under Trump's vision for making America great again, a vision closer to D.W. Griffith's 1915 movie, The Birth of a Nation, a film predicated upon white fear and denigration of the black other than that of an actual nation. In our current morally perilous moment, it is important to critically consider Trump's signing of an executive order that temporarily blocks both immigrants and non-immigrants from seven prominently Muslim countries: Syria, Iraq, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Yemen. This action has implications beyond questions of constitutional legitimacy. This ban, along with the plan to build a wall along the United States border with Mexico, is indicative of deeper issues regarding American white nativism and the fact that millions of Americans have become so gripped by hopelessness and fear that they are willing to overlook constitutional violations and ignore their own moral conscience. Trump's divisiveness is not only xenophobic, but also anti-theological, according to his own professed Christianity. At this time, we are symbolically walking from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he is telling us it is better and safer not to attend to the wounds and sorrows of the stranger. This is America's crucible, the Judaic concept of tikkun olam, repairing the world, is bastardized under Trump's executive order. We are instead in the midst of a dangerous form of idolatry that praises unmitigated power, valorizes American nativism, and borders on neo-fascism. In 1964, Martin Luther King Jr. said, "Without love, there is no reason to know anyone, for love will in the end connect us to our neighbors, our children, and our hearts." And just who are our neighbors? They are undocumented immigrants who seek to be with their families in the United States. They are refugees and strangers with whom we share a common humanity and who flee war-torn countries. As we fight against draconian orders that would make us turn our backs on those in need, we must also collectively fight against an Orwellian nightmare that would have us believe that 2 + 2 = 5. As Americans of all races reflect on our history this month, it is important that we acknowledge the systemic forms of marginalization, pain, and suffering that black people had to endure and that others may now face. In this way, we confront white America's sins unequivocally. We undertake a collective mourning for black people who were never meant to be included with the ideal norms of American democracy, yet forced themselves to dream as they faced nightmares, to continue breathing as they were suffocating from the stench of black bodies lynched and burned alive, and who forced themselves to stay alive when suicide would have been easier. Black History Month must not be just about black people, but white people too. It requires more than just having white students read a poem by a black poet. So if you are white, take this month, what's left of this month, and grieve. Find a private and sacred place to weep for those whose dark skin marked for subpersonhood. Consider the racist historical conditions that allowed you freedom of mobility, freedom of being, and a sense of personhood. Acknowledge that whiteness saved those who looked like you from the vicious barbarity visited upon black people. And in that moment, lament a country that continues to grant privileges to whiteness, that continues to fall far short of what is written on parchment. White people ought to use this month to engage in a shared form of vulnerability and mourning, a collective recognition with a fearless countenance of how white racist complicity and black suffering were historically linked and are currently intertwined. Such a courageous act of vulnerability is not about white guilt, but white responsibility. There is a specific injury that is necessary for white people. It is the kind of injury that will unsuture forms of trapped and concealed lies. King likened racism to a boil that can never be cured as long as it is covered up, but must be opened with all its pus-flowing ugliness. Part of the narrative of this election is that it was a repudiation of those voters who ignored the plight of poor and working class whites in this country. To those, I would say, I empathize with your economic pain and suffering. I understand your lack of economic growth, but are you then prepared to understand that, being black, we suffer economically, but also physically and spiritually under the institution of white racism? I agree with my fellow philosopher, Judith Butler, who said, "Let's face it, we are undone by each other, and if we are not, we are missing something." If I am to be undone by your economic pain and plight, then you must be willing to be undone by the economic and white systemic and prejudicial racist pain that we feel. Now, if you are white and you think that I am playing the race card, I ask you to perform this small task. Look at your face in the mirror. Allow your economic plight to anger you. And as you do, imagine your face encased in dark skin. And as you look in the mirror and begin to see a dark face look back, be honest with yourself. Isn't it better to be white and economically forgotten than to be economically forgotten and to be black under the same circumstances? My guess is you would rather the former. Butler also warns that we make a mistake when we take self-preservation to be the essence of the human. There is something indeed inhuman about insulating ourselves from the touch of the other, willfully ignoring the pain and suffering of the other. We are headed into an ethical abyss beyond which there may be no return. Before he was murdered on April 4, 1968, King had planned to deliver a sermon titled, "Why America May Go to Hell." Though King did not give that sermon, we should heed this prophetic warning. And that was It's Black History Month, Look in the Mirror, by George Yancey, who is a professor of philosophy at Emory University. He's the author of Black Bodies, White Gazes, and he's co-editor of Pursuing Trevon Martin and Our Black Sons Matter. He wrote Look in the Mirror for the New York Times. And now, an article by Karen Korematsu, When Lies Overruled Rights. When President Donald Trump signed an executive order temporarily banning travel from 7 majority Muslim countries, he hurled us back to one of the darkest and most shameful chapters of American history. Executive orders that go after specific groups under the guise of protecting the American people are not only unconstitutional, but morally wrong. My father and so many other Americans of Japanese descent were targets of just such an order during World War II. 75 years ago, this past Sunday, on February 19, 1942, under President Franklin D. Roosevelt's Executive Order 9066, all people of Japanese ancestry living on the West Coast were forced to leave their homes and report to incarceration camps. 2/3 were American citizens. Fred Korematsu, my father, then 23, refused to go. A proud and loyal citizen, he had tried to enlist in the National Guard but was rejected and was wrongly fired from his job as a welder in an Oakland, California shipyard. He was arrested and tried for defying the executive order. Upon conviction, he was held in a horse stall at a hastily converted racetrack until he and his family were moved to a desolate camp in Topaz, Utah. My father told me later that jail was better than the camp. He appealed his conviction to the U.S. Supreme Court. In his case, and in cases brought by Minoru Yasui and Gordon Hirabayashi, among the most infamous court cases in American legal history, the court in 1944 upheld the executive order. Justice Frank Murphy vehemently opposed the majority decision, writing in a dissenting opinion, "Racial discrimination in any form and in any degree has no justifiable part whatever in our democratic way of life." In the hysteria of war and racialized propaganda, my father's citizenship did not protect him. For him and the 120,000 other Japanese Americans incarcerated during World War II, there was no attempt to sort the loyal from the disloyal. In 1982, almost 40 years after my father's conviction, evidence was discovered proving that the wartime government suppressed, altered, and destroyed material evidence while arguing my father's, Yasui's, and Hirabayashi's cases before the Supreme Court. The government's claims that people of Japanese descent had engaged in espionage and that mass incarceration was necessary to protect the country were not only false, but had even been refuted by the government's own agencies, including the Office of Naval Intelligence, the FBI, and the Federal Communications Commission. With that evidence, my father reopened his case. In November 1983, he stood before a federal court judge, Marilyn Hall Patel, and said, "As long as my record stands in federal court, any American can be held in prison or concentration camps without a trial or a hearing." Judge Patel overturned my father's conviction, declaring that his case stands as a caution that in times of distress, the shield of military necessity and national security must not be used to protect governmental actions from close scrutiny and accountability. And that's a quote from Judge Patel. Around that time, the Federal Commission on Wartime Relocation and Internment of Civilians declared that the Korematsu case had been overruled in the court of history and found that my father's incarceration was based on race prejudice, war hysteria, and a failure of political leadership. Although his conviction was vacated, my father was keenly aware that his case never was formally overturned, even though it was widely discredited by scholars and even the courts. He was a quiet, soft-spoken man, but he spent the rest of his life speaking around the country about the government's misconduct that led to incarceration in hopes of preventing it from occurring again. In 1998, President Bill Clinton awarded him the Presidential Medal of Freedom for the brave stand he took against an unjust government action. In 1991, President George H.W. Bush declared, "The internment of Americans of Japanese ancestry was a great injustice, and it will never be repeated." But it can happen again. Since my father's death in 2005, I have taken on his work to remind Americans what happens when our Constitution is ignored in the name of national security. We need to scrutinize President Trump's executive orders and any other attempts to single out groups for repression. Let us come together to reject discrimination based on religion, race, or national origin, and to oppose the mass deportation of people who look or pray differently from the majority of Americans. "Stand up for what is right," my father said. "Protest, but not with violence. Don't be afraid to speak up. One person can make a difference, even if it takes 40 years. And that was by Karen Korematsu, "When Lies Overruled Rights." And she is founder and executive director of the Fred T. Korematsu Institute. And now, as sort of an epilogue, a letter to the New York Times by Yolanda from Boston, Massachusetts. "Any nation is first and foremost judged by its commitment to decency, law, and order, are but sorry appeals and false masks. It has been through human history perfectly lawful to torture, decapitate, and execute. It was lawful for slave masters to kill their slaves in Rome, for lordship in Europe to take young girls to their beds, and for industrialists to keep children workers captive and exploited as payment for their parents' debts. And it was lawful in Tsarist Russia to remove entire peoples. And it was lawful in the Reich to burn dreams, books, and people, because in law, in the final analysis, might trumps reason. So let's not be hypocritical here. Deporting millions might be construed as lawful, but it is cruel and incompatible with American values of our founders and of Christianity of any denomination, and will go down in history along with slavery and the genocide of Indian tribes as a moral monstrosity and a denial of decency and humanity. And that was a letter by Yolanda to the New York Times. And I dedicate today's program on this final week of Black History Month, to the memory of Malcolm X, who was assassinated 52 years ago this Saturday on February 25th, 1965. His beacon of resistance to white supremacy will most likely shine brightly through this period of increasing intolerance by a right-wing nationalist presidential administration and its rapidly totalitarian and racist policies that are infecting our neurotic democracy. Thomas Jefferson understood in the Declaration of Independence that people will patiently suffer the iron heel most of the time, but such excessively cruel acts as turning law enforcement against immigrants and refugees, as Hitler did to the Jews, can be the final indignity that erupts in a new, truly populist opposition against the hate and bigotry that emanates from the highest levels of government. Illegal immigration is not the major problem endangering the security of the United States. Militarizing the police and giving police powers to the military is a direct and very dangerous threat to constitutional governance. This has been Michael McCusker.